Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Ticker symbol of the day today is VOW. I'll give you one guess. Suffice it to say, not for them, the happy music. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 22nd day of September, Tuesday. Good as always to have you along, everybody. All right, so this past Friday afternoon, at the close of trading in New York, Volkswagen had a market capitalization of almost $87 billion. That is, that's what the market in all its wisdom thought the company was worth in its entirety. By the bell today, that number had been cut by a third. Volkswagen has lost $30 billion in value in 48 hours because it decided to cheat on an emissions test. That's raising lots of questions about that company. Dan Neal writes on cars and the industry that makes them for the Wall Street Journal. Dan, it's good to talk to you again.
Pleasure to talk to you, Kai. How are you doing?
I'm well, but let me ask you this. Where does Volkswagen conceivably go from here?
Boy, no one knows. We really are in very unfamiliar territory. On September 14th, which was a Monday night, I was at the VW AG group night in Frankfurt, and the CEO, Dr. Vinterkorn, was there, and he was all smiles. And VW sales were immense. I mean, they sold 10 million cars last year, 12 billion euro in profit, and 12% of the global market. And then 2 weeks later, it has all amazingly turned to ashes.
Dr. Vinterkorn, the CEO, has said that we will eventually learn the origin of this and how it came to pass. The very simple question, though, is what in the Sam Hill were they thinking when they did this?
That's a great question, because one of the things that's striking about it is the brazenness of it. This is a kind of hack you'd expect from a local tuner shop. There's a half a million cars in the U.S. that are so affected, and 11 million cars worldwide. This is the biggest scandal I have ever seen in my covering the auto industry.
One group we haven't heard much from, at least here in the States, Dan, are the VW dealers. Are they just hunkering down and riding this thing out and saying, whoa, no, don't look at us. It's all on them over in Germany.
Yes, VW has about 650 dealers. I imagine that it's pretty quiet there in the showroom today. I think what this is a deceit as a business strategy. Volkswagen Group was bound and determined to sell 10 million vehicles per year by 2018. And they did that last year, 2014. But they had to move aggressively in the United States. And part of their move in the United States was to push diesel powers. Well, that was their strategy. And obviously, corners were cut. And I think that this is going to send Volkswagen back to Audi territory back in the 80s for a while.
You mentioned diesel, and that brings up another question. You know, diesel has made great strides in the past, you know, I don't know what, 5-10-ish years or so to come back, clean diesel, all this. Is this sort of another death blows a little strong, but it doesn't help the diesel cause.
No, this is very bad advertising for diesel. And I mean, a lot of people like myself and people who want to be green consumers feel completely taken advantage of, because they bought these cars to be green. And now they find out that there's up to 40 times more emissions than a compliant car. So I think diesel, it's fair to say, could be on the way out.
So let me ask you this. Do you think this is an existential threat to this car company?
I don't know. It's because I've seen so many car companies come back from what seemed like certain death. I mean, General Motors certainly looked like a dead man walking a few years ago. And today it's, you know, one of the biggest and most profitable car companies. So it's hard to count out the enormous stake in the ground that VW AG has around the world. As I say, it's, you know, 12% of global market and 12 very prestigious brands. But it's going to cost them in ways that will have a long shadow, really.
Dan Neal, he writes on cars for the Wall Street Journal. Dan, thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you, Kai.
Elsewhere in Europe today, that is to say not at VW headquarters, leaders of European Union countries agreed to accept another 120,000 migrants. Germany alone agreed to take in more than 30,000 people, and Berlin is teaming up with a somewhat unusual partner to help process all those refugees. The UK newspaper The Independent reports that Germany is tapping the global consulting firm McKinsey & Company. Marketplace's Amy Scott is on that one.
McKinsey helps companies, governments, and NGOs all over the world tackle their management problems. And processing the tens of thousands of refugees streaming across Europe's borders is a big one.
I think the complexity of the response, it's probably pretty hard to overestimate it.
That's Eric Schwartz, a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State in charge of refugees. A few years ago, Sweden worked with consultants to develop a leaner process for granting asylum, says Elizabeth Collett. She directs the Migration Policy Institute Europe in Brussels.
It's part of a broader concern across the European Union that the national asylum systems that currently exist are extremely expensive to run and often quite inflexible.
McKinsey will reportedly help Germany's brand new migration office director clear a backlog of more than 270,000 asylum applications and try to shorten the process from 7 months per applicant to 2 months. The risk is getting too efficient, Collett says. She says many refugees have been traumatized by their experiences back home and don't trust authorities.
You know, you have to think about their well-being as well as asking them to tell the story of how they've come to be in this country claiming asylum.
Eric Schwartz, now at the University of Minnesota, says McKinsey has experience dealing with humanitarian crisis. He says the company assisted Asian governments in their response to the 2004 tsunami. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Today was kind of busy news-wise, so perhaps it escaped your notice that volatility has made a repeat visit to Wall Street. It was ugly for a good long while today before ending merely bad. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I don't know who's running protocol for the government of the United States right now, but one does wonder who decided it was a good idea to have the Pope, about whom more later, in town at the same time as the leader of the world's second biggest economy decides to swing by. Chinese President Xi Jinping is in Seattle, the first stop of a 7-day state visit. He's in Washington later this week, but starts today meeting with CEOs of some of America's biggest companies, Silicon Valley included. We got our China correspondent Rob Schmitz on the line from Shanghai to talk things over. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Kai.
So let me flip this a little bit. Xi Jinping is here. I want to get the perspective of American businesses trying to get by over in China. What are they seeing as this trip starts to happen?
Well, you know, gone are the days when China's government actively courted U.S. companies to set up shop here in China. You know, these days, there are all sorts of challenges for U.S. companies doing business here. You've got China's government putting more weight behind domestic companies, creating what many think is an unfair playing field. You've got more demands from local partners to transfer technology and intellectual property to Chinese companies. And now Xi Jinping's government is requiring U.S. tech companies to sign what it calls a pledge of compliance in order to continue to do business here in China. That'll require companies like Apple to hand over user data and even some intellectual property to the Chinese. So on the one hand, U.S. companies are making more than they've ever made here in China, but the cost of doing business in China has never been so high.
All right, so lay odds for me here for a second. President Xi is stopping in Seattle. He's going to have a big business roundtable. Former Secretary of the Treasury Henry Paulson is going to be there. A lot of high-profile CEOs. Lay odds that they're going to bring up any of this stuff with him.
Well, see, that's, I think, the tricky thing. You know, these companies are making so much money in China that it makes it difficult for them to be candid at events like this. You know, for example, just 6 years ago, Apple made only 2% of its revenue inside of China. Today, the company makes a quarter of all its revenue there, $46 billion so far this year. So talking about obstacles to doing business in China is difficult when these companies are making more than they've ever made here. Most people I've spoken to, while they're pleased that foreign companies are making bigger profits in China, they don't have much hope that it'll become any easier for American companies to do business in China anytime soon.
Give me the street level perspective here for a minute. Given all the, shall we say, ups and downs in the Chinese economy the past, I don't know, 6-8 weeks, how's this playing on the street? What's the China Daily, the state media, saying about this trip?
Well, of course, the state media is gushing over this trip, saying that this is going to be an opportunity for Xi Jinping to show the United States that China is an equal, not only economically, but militarily. And I think for Xi Jinping, he's been able to attract a very big group of heads of companies to come to one of his first events in his first city that he arrives to show his own countrymen that, look, we're important. You know, these companies consider us a very important market, and we're crucial for their business.
And the people riding all those motor scooters that clog the traffic in Shanghai, and the people walking on the street, and all those people that you see day to day, what about them?
I think for the most part, normal everyday Chinese aren't going to be paying too much attention to this visit. You know, politics is largely kind of a separate thing that many people don't see as part of their own lives. But here's the thing, you know, you've got these products that I think American companies make, you know, they do connect with that, you know, because you've got more and more people who are buying Apple products and other American products. And so I think that, you know, when we see the coverage on state media, and we're going to see a lot of it in the coming days, I think that they will connect with that kind of thing.
Rob Schmitz, our correspondent in Shanghai. Thank you, Rob.
Thanks a lot, Kai.
Today's economic indicator comes to us courtesy of the Recording Industry Association of America, the RIAA. Its latest numbers show streaming music is finally bringing in more money than the physical manifestation of music. That is CDs, DVD soundtracks, vinyl, 8-tracks, if you want to go way back, cassettes. Paid services like Spotify and Apple Music, and ad-supported ones as well, might one day become the best thing the music industry has going for it. But as Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports, that might not be good enough.
Back in June, on the eve of Apple's announcement about its new paid streaming service, Doug Morris, CEO of Sony Music, got up in front of a crowd at a music industry event and sounded downright optimistic.
I think it'll have a halo effect on the entire streaming business.
And he didn't stop there.
I think it is the beginning of an amazing moment for our industry.
It's a moment, all right, but amazing?
There's no doubt that the last, really, 2 years have been huge for streaming.
Mark Mulligan is an analyst at Media Research. According to the new data, which doesn't include Apple Music, revenue from paid streaming services has grown about 3% since last year. Revenue from ad-supported streaming services, like YouTube, was up 27%. But, says Mulligan,
that growth brings with it the questions of, what's the long-term future for streaming? Is, you know, can we afford to have the majority of people switching from paying to listening for free?
Of course, free is in the eye of the beholder. David Bakula is an analyst from Nielsen.
Well, and I mean, in effect, everybody's paying, even if it's an ad-supported stream, you know, there's still monetization coming in there.
And making some money is better than the old days, where everyone just stole music. But whether streaming services can stem the long decline of the music industry is an open question. Spotify, for one, says it's seen a bump in signups since Apple Music launched. And we'll find out soon if Apple's fans keep paying once their free trials expire. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
If you signed up for one of those Apple Music free trials when it came out, by the way, the free ends next week. Then it's $9.99 a month. If you're going to stick with it, let us know. It's Marketplace.org. Coming up.
Parents found out that a revolution was coming to their schools at the same moment that Oprah's national audience found out about it.
Oh, that's not good. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, down day pretty much around the world. At home, the Dow Industrial is off 179 points, 1%, 16,330. The Nasdaq dumped 72 points, 1.5%,
47.56. The S&P 500 slid 24 points, 1.2%, ended at 1942. Talk about a car wreck, man. Volkswagen admits it tampered with diesel emissions, and that casts suspicion on all diesel cars in Europe, where diesel is big. VW down 17%, Daimler down 7%, Bavarian Motor Works, BMW, off 6%. Day. Hear the one about the hedge fund guy who buys a 60-year-old life-saving drug and raises its price 5,000%? That got attention on drug prices in general and pharmaceuticals. Take a shot. Horizon Pharma down 12% today. I was unclear, by the way, when I said yesterday that price hike had been rescinded. The increase for a tuberculosis drug has been changed. Not so for Daraprim, the one that got all the attention. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. A presentation on fighting for free expression around the world takes place at the museum in Washington. It doesn't really feel like sweater weather here in Los Angeles, but the calendar says it's the first day of fall. And in our solar system, the farthest planet from the sun was discovered on September 23rd, 1846. A year on Neptune is 165 Earth years. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Pope is here. He landed in Washington earlier this afternoon. He's got the evening off before his public schedule starts tomorrow. If you do happen to tune into one of his sermons over the next couple of days, you might hear a phrase that we don't hear much or really ever in this country. The Pope likes to talk about the global north and south, his view of where the world's wealth tends to be and where the environmental effects tend mostly to be felt. And being who he is, that's a potent worldview as we gear up for the next set of global talks on climate change coming up in December in Paris. From our sustainability desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Before the white smoke at the Vatican declared him Pope, he was sometimes called Bishop of the Slums at home in Argentina. He frequented the so-called misery villages in Buenos Aires.
Argentina, at the beginning of the 20th century, was one of the wealthiest countries in the world.
Joseph Kabosky teaches economics at Notre Dame.
And they've, you know, fallen. Now they're a middle-income country. And so material poverty is a bigger issue in a place like Argentina.
Clearly, this pope emphasizes the local poor and the global poor. In his words, there's an inequality between the global north and the global south. It's literal. The southern hemisphere is poorer than the northern. And it's also a metaphor, says Duke environmental economist Brian Murray.
Well, the north and the south is a commonly used dichotomy to divide the rich and the poor.
The pope's climate encyclical speaks of an ecological debt owed to people in poorer countries. They suffer outsized effects of mining and drilling for minerals and energy. And they suffer outsized effects of climate change, says economist Jeffrey Sachs of Columbia University's Earth Institute. He advised the Pope's Vatican Council on Climate, and he Skyped us from South Africa.
The Pope is making a point that they are already suffering miserably from increasing environmental degradation, and they are likely to suffer the most, the earliest.
A defining paper on climate economics called the Stern Review finds developing countries tend to be warmer to start out with. They rely more on farming and stable rain patterns. And when they aren't stable, Sachs says, it can affect the viability of an entire country or region. Take Syria.
The droughts were unrelenting, leading to crop failures as well as soaring food prices. And that turned into mass protests, government crackdowns, and into a bloodbath and a catastrophe.
There is a policy implication here. The Kyoto Climate Treaty, the basis of global talks, and the Pope's encyclical assume the rich countries bear more responsibility for addressing climate change. As the thinking goes, they industrialized and polluted first, and greenhouse gases often linger for centuries.
What this will do, though, is provide the developing countries some bargaining power, if you will, by reference to the moral authority of the Pope.
They could lowball their emissions reductions at the big global climate summit this December in Paris. Now, the focus on the poor and the rich has drawn criticism in the U.S. that the Pope could be Marxist, which he's denied, or that he's reviving a doctrine of preference for the poor known as liberation theology. At the very least, this is meant to shake up the rich countries, says Berkeley energy physicist Dan Kamen. He also advised the Vatican.
We don't want to reduce the quality of life. We want to reduce the footprint of that life. And that hasn't been emphasized so much in Western capitalist economies, but it's where we're starting to see a very interesting conversation around living within our resource means.
So if you're listening to the Pope this week, expect polemics on what he calls the so-called first world and its responsibilities. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Five years ago, September of 2010, Mark Zuckerberg, the founder and CEO of Facebook, announced he was going to donate $100 million to fix the public school system in Newark, New Jersey. He'd been wooed by then Newark Mayor Cory Booker and the then and now governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie, political allies from different parties who'd come together to try to do something about an urban district where half the students didn't graduate. It started well. Didn't end quite the same way. Dale Ruskoff writes about it in her new book. It's called The Prize, Who's in Charge of America's Schools? Dale, welcome to the program.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Their stated goal, these three men, is to provide school reform, a model for it, for the entire country.
Right. Not just for Newark.
Yeah. That's a big bite to chew. That's a big chunk.
Yes. Well, this is the way Booker pitched it to Zuckerberg, and he had learned that the hedge fund billionaires and a lot of the people who had become very active in education reform think this way. They think about proof points and scaling up reform the way they would look for a proof point to scale up a startup. And I think it dovetailed with the way Zuckerberg was thinking about the role he wanted to play in philanthropy because, you know, here's somebody who at age 19 transformed global communications from his dorm room. So why wouldn't he think that he could have that kind of transformational impact in philanthropy as well?
Okay, so this is weakness point one, number one in this whole plan, as I read this book, which is that, yes, you've got your proof points, and yes, you've got $100 million, which later becomes $200 million with matching grants and all that stuff. The thing that Zuckerberg forgets, and maybe this is his point of naivete, which, as we will find out later in the tale, he has now overcome, is that there are real kids and real people and real teachers and, oh, by the way, politicians and bureaucrats with entrenched interests here.
Yes, and by the way, there's also a lot of poverty.
And poverty. Well, we're going to get there, too. But you're right. So there's a whole bunch of forces that give lie to the whole treat it as a startup thing is my point.
Exactly. Yes. A huge, huge flaw from the beginning, which set off an explosion in Newark, was that they didn't involve the people of Newark at all. I mean, this was announced on Oprah, and the parents of Newark school children found out that a revolution was coming to their schools at the same moment that Oprah's national audience found out about it. And The message from the beginning was, you people have failed. You don't know how to fix your own schools. We're going to do it for you, and we're going to save your children.
Last paragraph of the book. First sentence reads like this. To those who see education through the lens of students and classrooms, it is obvious that urban public schools are being asked to overcome nothing less than the effects of poverty. You can't just throw money at this.
Right. They would argue that they didn't throw money at it. I mean, they had a set of ideas. They wanted to expand charter schools. They wanted to increase the accountability of everyone in the district for the performance of children. But they didn't look at the ground level of the classroom and the children and the teachers who were trying to overcome all of the issues that children brought into the classroom.
And there's a great story about the kid who acts out all the time, and he says at some point, if I keep acting out, nobody's going to discover I can't read.
Yeah. His behavior problem was a learning problem, and it was also just a self-esteem problem. This is a kid who had failed all his life, and he couldn't imagine himself ever learning. And I think that the lesson is that when you have a real relationship of trust with a teacher, children can verbalize a lot. They really do understand what's going on.
Chris Christie, though he was born in Newark, now has set his sights on a bigger job and seemingly has left this reform effort behind. Cory Booker is now in the United States Senate. Zuckerberg seems to be the only one still engaged with education as a cause, and more importantly, he seems the only one that has learned a lesson, right? Because he did a big thing up in San Francisco, and he said, we're going to do this one from the ground up. We're going to do it differently.
Yes. I mean, he didn't specify that it was going to be different, but if you just look at the details, It's incredibly different. He's looking to districts in the Bay Area. He's asking the staff of his philanthropy to spend a lot of time in the field, getting to know the community, getting to know the parents and the teachers, and try to make sure that what they want to do is what the community wants and that they have the ideas from the ground level of the people who know education the best. So I think that's a really strong statement about what they hope to do and how different it is from what they were doing in Newark.
I wonder maybe if the lesson from this then is about the Newark case. Look, don't do what these guys did.
Well, I think that a lot of people are going to draw that conclusion, but I hope they don't draw the conclusion that it's hopeless, because it's not. Just don't do it that way.
Dale Russikoff, her book is called The Prize, Who's in Charge of America's Schools. It's a good read. Dale, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, maybe it's the aviation geek in me or my appreciation of promptness. I don't know, but I thought this was interesting. If you pull up the flight path of the Pope's plane today on sites like Flight Radar or Flight Aware, you'll see it does a couple of big circles over North Carolina. It seems, reports the Atlantic magazine via officials on the ground at Andrews Air Force Base, that President Obama and Vice President Biden were running late, and so the word went out for the Pope to kill some time. Or maybe he was early, I don't know. Either way, check it out yourself. We've got a link on our website, marketplace.org. As far as Wall Street today, let me say this about that. It could have been worse, so much worse. The Dow off 179 points, 1%. The NASDAQ down 72 points, about 1.5%. The S&P 500 slid 24 points, 1.2%. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. The senior digital producer around here is Nishat Kurwa. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.